I believe that today's class is going to be devoted in great measure to reading certain parts of the text. And it's going to be in order to fully elaborate on what we talked about 2 weeks ago, which was Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's unique approach to Jewish belief. And that is what we call the historical approach. There are facts of history, something that takes place in the presence of many people takes on a life of its own. And he's going to say it, there are some very beautiful sentences in the way in which he expresses it. And he's going to deepen this whole idea that here there are so many events so clearly detailed in Torah, all of them to have taken place in the presence of millions of people. We're talking about the Exodus from Egypt, we're talking about the 40 years in the desert. We're not saying that a vision appeared to somebody somewhere which he later shared with others that can be proven or can't be proven. It may be completely the result of one's own imagination. Here we're talking about clear facts. In regards to the fact, he's also going to deal with the idea, but there are people who say they don't believe it. So he's going to say, not believing historical facts is the stubbornness of the heretic. The truth can be staring him in the face, and he's going to say, no, it's not so. It's not so. We have it, until today, we have the same thing time and time again. That the truth is clearly there, and there are those who, because of their own reasons, in other words, everybody has an agenda. Everybody has a personal agenda. It's very difficult for people to be absolutely purely objective. There are, of course, those who, by virtue of the fact that they are able to say that Torah is, God forbid, not divine. So, of course, that means that they are freed from any responsibility to fulfill the mitzvahs of Torah. But we have to look at it from an objective point of view. So now, he had spoken to the Christian, he had spoken to the Muslim, he had originally decided that he's not going to speak to the Jew, because of the fact that the Jews are a minority in the world. They are a despised people. And this was written a long time ago, and it's referring to events that may have taken place a few hundred years before that. We're talking about 8th century, 9th century. So, you know, at least there's something that's a constant in Jewish history. The constant is they always hate us. And if we think for some brief period of time that they don't hate us, then we're making a terrible, terrible mistake. All right. Anyway, both the Christian and the Muslim, when they were asked about their religion, both of them responded by making an opening statement. And that opening statement is that we believe in God who created the entire universe, created me, created you, brought all sorts of a world with a whole animal kingdom and plants and flora, all sorts of things were all brought into being. Now when he finally asks the Jew, and that is paragraph 11. Mm-hmm. It's on page 44. Mm-hmm. Right immediately before it, it says he then invited a Jewish rabbi and asked him about his belief. I always wonder about that. Do you know of any other kind of rabbi? All right.
He doesn't know
it's a Jew. You see, in the Hebrew it's different. A Jewish wise man. So in this sentence, you see why I may like the Hebrew better than I like this English. Now I have another English.
You should have tried it. translated it was.
Let me see. I have another translation. What is it? This was 11. Uh-huh. Oh. I 2 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, I was invited to be the guest speaker for a Yom Yerushalayim celebration in Los Angeles. The religious Zionist community made quite a big, very beautiful celebration, and I was the guest speaker. And the fellow, my host for the 36-hour whirlwind in Los Angeles, was a fellow by the name of Rabbi Daniel Korobkin. And in order that I should remember his visit, he gave me a copy of a book he wrote. He translated the Kuzri. He translated the Kuzri. This is the translation you have in front of you must be at least 100 or more years old. This is just a few years ago. And in some places, it's quite clear that his translation is a little better. And so he summoned a Jewish sage. That's a little better than a Jewish rabbi.
Translated in England,
1905. 1905, so it's close. I said 100 years, huh? Okay.
But Rabbi,
what? This
was written originally in Arabic.
It was written in Arabic.
Yeah. So then there was a translation into Hebrew.
Then there was a translation into Hebrew. And then in our generation here in Eretz Yisrael, there was a new translation by Yehuda Evan Shmuel. Uh-huh. Yehuda Evan Shmuel translated again from the Arabic. Uh-huh. From the Arabic. And it's the Ibn Tibbon original translation is a little bit heavy at places. Here he gets, it flows much more smoothly in this translation, even though since I originally learned the Kuzri from the Ibn Tibbon translation, there are certain sentences that I just remember over there that are so powerful, and I'll tell them to you when we get there. But just as an aside, there was an article in the latest Jewish Action by Chaim Eisen. Chaim Eisen teaches Kuzri here, and he took exception to one thing in one page in the Korobkin translation. In one of the addenda at the end of the Sefer, and I'm not going to go into it now, I'll deal with it another time, but he has a small chapter, 3 pages, entitled On Living in Israel. We're going to see that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi was an Ohev Eretz Yisrael of the profoundest order. In other words, if we want to express about Eretz Yisrael, as we pointed out in the first year, there is nothing better than Libi B'Mizrach V'Anochi B'Sof Marav. What was written by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi captured the intense love that a Jew traditionally has for Eretz Yisrael. And he has a little section here called On Living in Israel. I'll find an opportunity in the course of one of the next Jewish shiurim to deal with this, because it's something that I've dealt with in shiurim before. But otherwise, it's not a bad translation. Okay.
But what did Rabbi Chaim object?
Who?
What did he object to?
Rabbi Eisen.
Then I have to tell you what it says in that addenda. So then I'll have to change the whole focus of the shiur today.
So you only brought it up to say he criticized the translation?
No. He wrote, first of all, an essay saying what a good translation it is, but anybody who writes a critique of a book also has to find something that disagrees with. Mm-hmm. And here he found something, I believe, correct to disagree with. I won't withhold anything from you. It's going to come, sir. It's going to come. All right. Here, this is the opening statement. The rabbi said to him, I better get back to. The rabbi said to him, I believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Is that what he said?
Yeah.
No. The Hebrew says Yaakov.
Really?
The Hebrew says Yaakov.
What page are we?
44. We are on page 44.
Okay.
Paragraph 11. I believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, who led the children of Israel out of Egypt. You see already we're talking history. Who led the children of Israel out of Egypt with signs and miracles, who fed them in the desert, gave them the land, after having made them traverse the sea and the Jordan in a miraculous way, who sent Moses with his law and subsequently thousands of prophets. The Gemara Masechta the Megillah says the number of prophets that arose in Israel were Kiflayim Kiyotze Mitzrayim. Very poetic. Double the number of those that went out of Egypt. 600,000 Jews went out of Egypt. The number of prophets that arose in Israel were 1,200,000. And then the Gemara goes on to say, ah, the prophet was in a sense like a Rebbe, but a great deal more than a Rebbe. People went for advice to a prophet. People went for a bracha to a prophet. People went through all sorts of matters of a very personal nature to a Navi. So the Gemara says, any prophecy that was necessary for all generations for Klal Yisrael was written and became part of the Tanakh. And that which was not necessary for Klal Yisrael for all generations was not written down. In other words, if we would take everything that was said by 1,200,000 prophets, it would be unbelievable. But that was not necessary for all generations, so therefore that wasn't written. Anyway, you see what he's telling us? So we have, it's going to be, every statement that he makes here is going to be terribly important. The fact that there are thousands of prophets, he's going to make a very important point of the philosophers never produced a single prophet. And there's going to have to be good reason why the whole world, everybody believes that there are prophets in Israel. I mean, every guy knows that there were prophets in Israel. Nobody denies that. Nobody denies that there was a Yeshayahu, a Yirmiyahu, a Yecheskel, a Hosea, an Amos, a Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi. Nobody denies it. But there's nobody who said that there was ever a Greek prophet. There were no prophets. And there's going to be a good reason why there are no Greek prophets, and he's going to explain that. Anyway, and subsequently thousands of prophets who confirmed his law by promises to the observant and threats to the disobedient. Our belief is comprised in the Torah, a very large domain. A very large domain, what he means is, in Hebrew it comes out so much better, v'hadvarim arukim. There's a great deal to say about this. Mm-hmm. And he's going to Torah. The king gets upset. And the king says, I had not intended to ask any Jew, because I am aware of their reduced condition and narrow-minded views, as their miseries left them nothing commendable. And I would say, I didn't want to ask you Jews, because I know that you're really insignificant, you're despised, you're hated. Now, shouldst thou, O Jew, not have said, he doesn't like the introduction. Shouldn't you have said to me that you believe in the God who created heaven and earth, and me and you and all human beings? That's the way the Christian began. That's the way the Muslim began. That's so much grander, so much more majestic, that you believe in the God who's the creator of the whole cosmos. Now, shouldest thou, Jew, not have said that thou believest in the creator of the world, its governor and guide, and in him who created and keeps thee, and such attributes which serve as evidence for every believer, and for the sake of which he pursues justice in order to resemble the Creator in his wisdom and justice. Very heavy English. Anyway, what he's saying is, shouldn't you have told me that you believe in God who created heaven and earth and created me and you, and that our responsibility is that we should attempt to emulate and be like God? So the rabbi, the chaver, responds by saying, you know who would begin his description of God as creator? What you express is religion based on speculation and system, the research of thought, but open to many doubts. I'll explain. Now ask the philosophers, and you'll find that they don't agree on one action or one principle, since some doctrines can be established by arguments which are only partially satisfactory and still much less capable of being proved. He says, listen, when you start telling me, if I would start by telling you that I believe in the God who created heaven and earth, I'm beginning to walk in, I start at the very beginning by walking into a minefield. Because if you're going to start talking to the philosophers, you're going to find those who do agree that there was creation, those who don't agree that there was creation. What we're talking about is something that's open to speculation, something that's open to all sorts of question. Maybe so, maybe not so. Now watch, he's going to come to his conclusion in a moment. So the king says, what you say now, O Jew, seems to be more to the point than the beginning, and I should like to hear more. Because at first he was upset with him, why he said, I believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who took us out of Egypt. So now he says, but wait a minute, what he's really referring to is the fact that will come out later, and Rambam speaks a great deal about it, you can't really prove creation. You can have arguments for creation, arguments against creation. It's not something that you can prove clearly, unquestionably, by logic. And therefore, there are two different approaches. The fact is that Aristotle and Plato, and we're going to talk about them, are also disagree about creation. Aristotle basically says that he speaks of the eternity of the world. The world always was. According to Plato, there may not always have been a world, but the matter from which the world came into being was always here. The difference between Aristotle and Plato is that according to Plato, there is place left for the will of God to take that matter and create man. There can be creation which is the will of God, and as far as Torah is concerned, that's all we care about. If you say everything was always here, then there was no act of God's will creating the world. So we can't get, with Aristotle, on the question of creation or the world always having been here, we really part company with Aristotle. With Plato, who says that there was a prime evil matter, and he's going to talk about it later, so then all this prime evil matter can now be imposed upon by God's will to create man. As long as there's creation by the will of God, we don't care how it happened. That's good for us. So now he says, but whatever the philosophers say, you can't really prove, he'll make this point later, there's no way that you can prove positive, that the world was created by an act of God's will. You can't, by the same token, prove that the world was always here. It's something that's simply not given to any kind of proof. Nobody was here. Do you understand? There was nobody here. There's no way to prove it. The Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi are going to say that the reason why Aristotle chose, why did he choose eternity of the world over creation, when the fact is, from a logical point of view, they're pretty much balanced. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi even says that there may be a little bit of a greater inclination logically to say that it was brought into being by an act of creation. By the way, an act of creation, of course, is much easier to understand. As we pointed out, a perfect world such as ours, now, I'm not talking about the people in it, I'm talking about the flora and the fauna, the whole world, there's absolute perfection. The human body is absolute perfection. We're talking about such precision in the world. It just makes it a great deal easier to believe in creation than to believe that all of this came about by its own. As we quoted the Chovat HaLevavot that says, if somebody's going to tell you, you know how this printed page came into being? Because somebody spilled ink on the piece of paper, and then presto, it came into being. I mean, it certainly is much easier to believe in creation than it is to believe that the world was always here. But whichever way you look at it, creation is something that can't be proven or disproven one way or the other. Why did Aristotle choose eternity? So later on, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to say, because Aristotle was from Greece, and the Greeks simply didn't have a Masorah, They didn't have tradition going back to other Arishon. He started from a tabula rasa. He started with no information whatsoever, and by dint of his own intellect, he had to arrive at certain conclusions. Would he, at the crucial moment when he is weighing the two sides, was there creation or was the world always here, he would have had a reliable tradition from Adam, Sheis, Enosh, Kenon, Mahalalel, Yered, Chanoch, Lemach, Metushelach. You think I know if they were all right, but I don't think you can start out with me on that. All right? When you have a direct line of historic evidence, so therefore, of course, we're going to, the two sides are so balanced, we will choose creation. But he didn't have that. Greeks didn't have that. They were not from the family of Shem. They were from the family of Yefet. They were cut off from the tradition. So therefore, he had to choose an intellectual one. But yes?
So what about Plato, who was also Greek?
So you can say maybe Plato. It is still not, by the way, he does not say that there was an act of... let me explain. According to Plato, it's possible for there to have been an act of creation, because all he says is not that the world was always here, but that there was matter in the universe from which it could be. He never took the step of saying that there was indeed an act of creation. If he would have had the tradition from the family of Shem, going back to Adam, then he would have made that decision too. So therefore, also now the king is getting a little bit more interested in what the rabbi has to say. So number 15 says, "Truly the beginning of my speech was just the proof, and so evident that it requires no other argument." This is, I'm going to have to read it in the Hebrew. Number 15 says, "Ulam patach, Petach Devarai, Puhu Hamofeit Gedolam Izot, Huha Hochachachachare, Ein Tzorech Lobirai Yavolov Hamofeit." This is such an important sentence. Comes out better in here. He's saying, while those who want, who say that we believe in the God who created the world, you can't end the statement there, period. You're going to have to prove it. If you say, if a Christian and a Muslim say we believe in the God who created the world, hold on. How do you know? How do you know he created the world? How do you know the world came into an act of through an act of creation? But when I open my statement and I say, I believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the one who took us out of Egypt and took us 40 years through the desert and miraculously crossed the Red Sea and the Jordan, I cannot be required to bring any proof to that, because the statement itself is already its greatest proof. What does it mean? So you're wondering, what am I talking about? So the poor king of the Khazars also doesn't know. And in number 16 he says, how so? What do you mean? 17, the rabbi says, allow me to make a few preliminary remarks, for I see thee disregarding and depreciating my words. I see you doubt me. Let me explain a little bit what I'm talking about. And here comes what is known as the parable of the king of India. The parable of the king of India. Let me hear your remarks. The rabbi, if you were told that the king of India was an excellent man, commanding admiration, deserving high reputation, one whose actions were reflected in the justice which rules his country and the virtuous ways of his subject, would this bind you to revere him? You heard about the king of India, that the king of India is a tzaddik, a man of great justice, great wisdom. Would you have to believe that? So the king says, how could this bind me? Why do I have to believe it? Well, I'm not sure. First of all, I don't know whether the justice of the people of India is natural and not dependent upon that king, or due to the king, or both. I don't even know if there is a king for that matter. So the rabbi says to him the following. But what happens if his messenger, a messenger from the king of India, comes to you And he brings you presents which are known only to be procurable in India. You can only buy it in India and in the royal palace, accompanied by a letter. And this messenger comes with a letter from the king of India, and it's addressed to you, in which it is distinctly stated from whom he comes, and to which are added drugs to cure your diseases, to preserve your health, poisons with which to fight your enemies, and other means to fight and kill them without battle. I mean, you get sort of living evidence that there is a king of India. Would this make you beholden to him? So the king says, certainly. For this would remove my former doubt that the Indians have a king. Now I have somebody I can touch, a living messenger from the king of India. I should also acknowledge that a proof of his power and dominion is which he has sent me all sorts of messages that are very beneficial to me. I'm learning a great deal from the directly from the king of India. How would you then describe the king of India after the messenger comes and he tells you all of these things and he brings you a letter from the king of India? How are you going to describe the king of India? So the king says, in terms about which I'm quite clear, and to these I would add others which were at first rather doubtful, but are no longer so, others my doubts are going to begin to disappear. And on the basis of this letter that has come from the king of India, I'm going to be able to describe him in great detail. Says the Chavir, the Talmud Chacham, now says to the king, that's exactly what happened now. That's what I did. In this way, I answered your first question. And this is the way Moshe addressed Paro when he came to him. When he walks into Paro, Moshe doesn't say, I come from the God who created heaven and earth. Elokei ha'ivrim, I'm coming from the God of the Hebrews, the God of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. He doesn't stand there and get into any philosophical discussions with Paro. The God of the Hebrews sent me to you, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know why he said that? Now, watch how he's going to start bringing in all sorts of fascinating ideas. When he says to Paro, the God of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov sent me, we don't hear Paro say, who's that? When he talks about God, he says, Mi Hashem, who's God that I should listen to? But he never questions him, Abraham? Who's Abraham? Who's Isaac? Who's Jacob? You know he doesn't question it? Because the whole world knew Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. For Abraham was well known to the nations, who also knew that the divine spirit was in contact with the patriarchs and cared for them and performed miracles for them. Everybody knew that Avraham was still a king. This was not something new. This was not some kind of a hoax that he's pulling on Paro. He stands before the king and he says, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Oh, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, these are names that are well known. He didn't say, Moshe didn't say the God of heaven and earth. Nor did he say, my creator and your creator and thine sent me. In the same way, when God appears to the Jewish people, the beginning of the Ten Commandments is, not Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Barosi Shamayim Baretz, not I am God, your God, who created heaven and earth. How does God introduce himself to the Jewish people? I'm the one who took you out of the house of bondage, out of Mitzrayim. You know why? Because they're all talking about historic realities. They're not going into the philosophic arena that can be proven or cannot be proven. Jews know that they came out of Egypt. This is the God who took them out of Egypt. He didn't say the God of heaven and earth. Nor did he say, my creator and thine. In the same way, God commenced his speech to the assembled people of Israel. I am God whom you worship, who has led you out of the land of Egypt. He didn't say, I'm the creator of the world and your creator. This is the same way that I now spoke to you, prince of the Khazars,
when you asked me about my creed, about my religion, I answered you as was fitting. I spoke to you exactly the way Moshe spoke to Pharaoh and exactly the way God spoke to the Jewish people. I answered thee as was fitting, and is fitting to the whole of Israel, who knew these things first from personal experience. Nobody asked, what's Mitzrayim? What's the house of bondage? Now, for the next sentence, I'm going to read it in the English and then I'm going to read it in Hebrew. Because this sentence is the sentence that really defines and describes Rabbi Yehuda Levi's whole approach to this question. And it says, and is fitting for the whole of Israel who knew these things first from personal experience and afterwards through uninterrupted tradition, which is equal to the former. Uninterrupted tradition means like my personal experience. The whole dar b'dar in every generation, a person has to see himself as though he went out of Egypt. How are historic facts established? Do I have to have proof that there was a Second World War? No. Do I need proof that there was a fellow called Napoleon? No, I don't need proof that there was a fellow called Napoleon. By virtue of the fact that he existed, and this uninterrupted tradition, my knowledge is equal to the knowledge of the person who stood next to Napoleon. That's what history is all about. Otherwise, it's impossible to live in this world. I mean, there are facts that are established by virtue of the fact that they happen. Let me read it in the Hebrew form. This is the underlying fundamental principle upon which everything that the Kuzi says is going to explain. So he says, this is Dabar. I started off by telling you something that became clear to the children of Israel, Barishona, at first, Al Pira Ot Eneyem, because they saw it with their own eyes, personal experience, V'acharechein, and afterwards, Nimsal Ish Mipi Ish B'Kabbalah, it was transmitted from person to person, Hadomel Lemare Eneyem, that's dozen of crucial words. Direct, uninterrupted tradition is equal to seeing it. How much the Rambam says, and how many times you have been safe at the bottom. Remember the day that you stood at Chorev. Teach your children and your children after you, so that it is ki'ilu they too stood at Har Sinai. All of the events of Jewish history are part of our direct, uninterrupted tradition, and that's equal to having been there, regardless of what anybody's going to tell you. As I pointed out earlier, as you can say it later, to say that it didn't happen, you have to be a stubborn avocados. Now the king gets a little, he accepts what he says, but now he gets a little shook up. If so, then he says, then your Torah is very exclusive and it doesn't count me into the equation. Because of all of this is the direct tradition going down from generation to generation, and that's as though I had seen it myself, that excludes me. I'm not part of that tradition. If so, then he really says, then I have nothing further to discuss with you. It's all over. Rav Yehuda Levi is going to be very, very honest and brutal. He says, yes, indeed, you're right. You're right. Number 27. Yes, you're right. Yes. But any Gentile who joins us unconditionally shares our good fortune without, however, being quite equal to us. He says, the ger, this is going to shake him up, and he shakes up a little bit. The gear is not equal.
And yet we learn that
wait a minute. I know you do so. I knew you were going to get all upset. Right? He's going to point out later on
it's his opinion that a ger cannot be a prophet. That's the only thing that separates the ger. Not quite equal to us. All of the great promises that God gave to the Jewish people, all of the great blessings that are ultimately to come upon Klal Yisrael, the ger will share equally. But there's one thing, and this is also going to be extremely significant to the whole approach of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and we're going to start moving into that soon. You know what? Maybe it's even better. I'll give you a general outline, and then as we come to it, we'll see what he's talking about. It's really, you can call it racist, but it's a gene philosophy. Odom HaRishon was just plain different. Odom HaRishon was perfection. Odom HaRishon had many children, but his genes, with that divine perfection, went over only to Hevel, not to Cain. With the death of Hevel at the hands of his brother, there's nobody in the world to whom the genes of Adam have been transmitted. Until about 130 years later, they have shaped. The 10 generations from Adam till Noah, and the 10 generations from Noah till Abraham, it may be, according to Yehuda Halevi, different than others. The fact is that the Ramban we learned yesterday in Chumash clearly leaves the impression that during this entire period of time, everybody lived for hundreds of years. According to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, it doesn't have to be true. According to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, only those people that carried the genes of Adam lived long. He's going to say later on, he's going to say that Adam had many children. Ultimately, he had many children. Vayolad, Banu, he had sons and he had daughters. All of them were like the peel of the fruit. Only one was the fruit, and that was Shet. Shet had many children. All of them were like the peel, but only one was the fruit who carried the genes of Adam. Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Yared. Now, he also makes a very fascinating statement. Sometimes there are people who are carriers of the genes and can only transmit it to the next generation, but do not really develop themselves. The classic example is Terach. Terach was a Terach, right? Terach was nothing to write home about. But you know what he was? He was a carrier of the genes of Adam HaRishon. And he transmitted them to Avram. Avram had two children, Yitzchak and Yishmael. Yitzchak had the genes, Yishmael didn't. Yitzchak had Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov had the genes, Esav didn't. Yaakov was the most unusual of all. He's the only one who has 12 children, and all 12 children carry the genes of Adam HaRishon. And they, therefore, are the ones that are, God is going to create the unique people upon the face of this earth. Now, it sounds like out of a cartoon that God shows us, and he's going to be dealing with the question of, the Kuzari, the king is going to ask him, why didn't God give Torah to the whole world? I mean, why just... All right, we'll get to that. But what he's saying, therefore, if what Klal Yisrael is, are the carriers of those genes, the ger doesn't have the goods. He doesn't have those genes. But he is equal to us in all areas except for one. And you're going to see right away, I'm taking you a little bit of a head so you should understand what's going on over there. That means, therefore, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, it may very well be that everybody else lived the 70, 80, 90, or 100 years. But those who carry the genes of Adam HaRishon, they're the ones who live for a long, long time. All right, go ahead, Malka.
About the genes.
Yeah.
Harufua hayom maskima mila v'mila.
I'm not going to question you, because if you're agreeing with me, I'm perfectly happy. I mean, there's no question that the genes are extremely important. My wife always says the greatest thing that parents can give to their children is to have good genes. Parents have good genes to give that to the
children. But they can't choose which genes to have in life.
Yeah, they can't choose that. That's all.
The children also can choose what to take.
I have a cousin who died 2 days ago, was buried yesterday, lived in Cholon. He was 90. I have an aunt who's 94, Gunson. There's a strain, I mean, I don't know if I have it, but there's a strain in the Gold family of longevity. I just don't know if I have my father's genes. If I have my father's genes, I'm okay. If I have my mother's genes, I'm not okay. Not at all okay. But here, 94, my father was 87, 88. And throughout the family, there's longevity. So genes are extremely important. So Rabbi Yehuda Levi says the choice of the Jewish people is because the Rosh Hashanah knew that these people are all carrying the genes. But you can see how he, that I was going to explain, the carrying of these genes therefore places much greater responsibility. Yes, go ahead.
If he bases his whole argument on the fact that we were witnesses, and the tradition continued, how can he go back to Adam? We were not witnesses of Adam.
Oh no, we were certainly not witnesses to how Adam came into being. But we knew that he existed.
How?
And
Oh,
he's going to explain that soon.
Okay, I can't wait.
Well, he's going to explain that soon. This is going to be so crucial to the proof of Torah. That Torah's true, that's going to be very important. You just have to
wait,
just control yourself, yes.
And the Rabbi told, if a convert doesn't have the Jewish genes from...
He doesn't.
...back from Adam, once he's converted, do his children get the Jewish genes?
That's a very good question. Logically, it doesn't, unless, of course, he marries a Jewish woman. If he marries a Jewish woman, she may be the carrier.
No, but King David...
Yeah.
From Ruth.
King David came from... yeah. But King David's mother, she was Jewish. She was not a convert. Just hang in. I threw out a lot of ideas. Let's go. We've got to move. We have to move. No. Okay. Yes. So that was 27. Now you can sense already in the response of the king that he's getting upset again. And the way he addresses him, Jew, I see you quite altered and your words are poor after having been so pleasant. Because he just now told him that the ger will simply never be equal to us. So now the king is very upset. So the rabbi says, poor or pleasant, give me your attention and let me express myself more fully. Isn't that what I just said a moment ago? Just wait. Have a little supplement and we'll explain what it's all about. So the Kuzari says, say what you wish. I can't say wilt. I'm sorry. I'll wilt if I have to say it. I can't say it. Let's see. That was number 30. I can't say it. That's all. Say what you wish. The Kuzari said, say what you wish. That's one of the great accomplishments of Rabbi Kuropkin's translation, is that he removed the dies and the dimes. But all right, you can do it normally. So he says the following. The laws of nature comprise nurture, growth, and propagation with their powers and all conditions attached thereto. This is particularly the case with plants and animals, to the exclusion of earth, stones, metals, and elements. All right. I think I'm going to have to explain what's going on here. He's going to talk about the various levels of creation. Level number one, what he calls over here the laws of nature, is really what the Kuzri refers to as Inyan HaTiv'i. The Inyan HaTiv'i is organic behavior. Organic behavior takes into consideration
nurture, that's nourishment, there's growth, and there's birth, propagation, and all of those powers and all of the conditions apply to that which grows and to living beings. It does not include the inanimate object, stone and earth, or the chemical elements. Stone, earth, chemical elements don't propagate. They don't give birth. They don't need nourishment. So, inyan hativi, that is, if we will take nature beginning with domain, domain is the inanimate. Above the domain comes the tzomeach, that which grows. Now, he has the some of them together, but let me give you the four levels of creation. Domain, tzomeach, chai, medaber. Domain is the inanimate object. Tzomeach is that which grows. Okay? All the trees and the flowers and the grass, everything in the world that grows. After that comes chai, that which has life in it. Moment it moves, that's the whole animal kingdom, but it still doesn't have intelligence. Above that is medaber. Medaber, the term for intelligent being, is the being that can speak. Those are the four levels. Now, he's going to be moving through the four levels. In number 32, he says, yes, that's a general rule that now you have to detail it for me, but it's true. So he goes into 33, and he says, b'inyan hanashi. Now here, I have to point it out. The translation soul is just not a good translation at all. When he talks about nefesh, in the Hebrew it's nefesh. Nefesh can be translated as soul, but it doesn't mean what soul means in English. Nefesh in Hebrew means an organism that has life in it.
Nefesh kol chai.
That has life in it. And watch how he describes it. Or you can call it animal behavior. We're not talking, a soul always leaves with the impression something, you know, may his soul be blessed. That's all we're talking about at all. We're talking about nefesh. Nefesh means a plant doesn't move. Plants don't pick themselves up and move. And if it moves, there may be a terrorist or a commando over there. You understand? They don't move. The tzomeach doesn't move. That which grows doesn't move. What about the chai, the bal chai? That which has a nefesh. Nefesh meaning the ability to move. That is the animal kingdom. Uh-huh. Now read it that way. Animal behavior, not soul. As regards animal behavior, it is given to all animated beings, all beings that move. The result is movement, willpower, external as well as internal senses and such like. No, there are all sorts of instincts that an animal has. It has an instinct of self-preservation. It can sense when there is danger, even when a human being wouldn't know that there is danger. This is all part of nefesh. So he says, yes, this too cannot be contradicted, okay? Now there's another level. The next level in Hebrew is inyan ha-sichli, the intellect. Ah, or what can be called medaber, the human being who speaks. Speaking represents the idea of an intelligent being. So he says, intellect is man's birthright above all living beings. This leads to the development of his faculties, his home, his country. In other words, the idea I imagine animals don't go to the poles. I mean, human beings go to the poles. They don't necessarily always vote like human beings. But all right, it represents the idea of intelligence, having a country, running a government, not always, I say, very intelligent, from which arise administrative and regular laws. So he says this is also true. Now comes, this is the crunch. Once we have gone from domain, the inanimate, to the tzomeach, that which grows, to the Chai, the living being who moves. We've come, it would seem, to the top, which is the Medaber, the intelligent being, man. Now he asks, the Chaver asks the king, what's higher than that? Is there another level?
Yes.
Which is the next highest degree? So the king says, great wise man. So the Chaver tells him, no. Great wise man is not a difference in kind. It's not in the essential nature of the wise man to be different than all other human beings. That's a difference in degree. Some people are smarter and some people are less smarter. What I'm asking you is there a being that exists on the face of this earth that is different in his essential nature and in his kind? Is there a fifth level above Domen, Sameach, Chai, Medaber? So, number 40, if this is what you want to have somebody above man, and wisdom is not the that which differentiates one man from another, then there is no degree above man among tangible things. There are four levels, Domen, Sameach, Chai, Medaber. These words are going to be important. Domen, Sameach, Chai, Medaber. We need to talk about it. So the rabbi says, what happens if we find a man who walks into fire without hurt, or abstains food for some time without starving, on whose face a light shines which the eye cannot bear, who is never ill, nor ages, until having reached his life's natural end, who dies spontaneously just as a man retires to his couch to sleep on an appointed day and hour, equipped with the knowledge of what is hidden as to the past and future, is such a degree not visibly distinguished from the ordinary human degree, if you have a human being like that? I mean, this is obviously far, far different than any other human being that ever existed on the face of this earth. So the king says, this is indeed the divine and seraphic degree. Like an angel, like an angel. If it exists at all, he's not sure that there is such a fifth category. It belongs to the province of the divine influence, but not to that of the intellectual, human, or natural world. You see, intellectual, human, or natural, those were the three levels that he was talking about. So the rabbi says, these are some of the characteristics of the undoubted prophets through whom God made himself manifest, and who also made known that there is a God who guides them as he wishes, according to their obedience and desire. He's describing prophets in general, and Moshe Rabbeinu in particular. And it's going to be very important to describe Moshe. Nobody else in this world has evidence of having come face to face for 40 years with an individual like Moshe Rabbeinu. We all saw it, we all witnessed it, we all experienced it, and we transmitted it to our children. And you should know, he's going to make a beautiful statement later. Someone, I'll let you in on all of it. Who cares? There's so much to learn here anyway. The Jews are an intelligent people. It may not seem that way right now. But Jews essentially are a very intelligent people. And one of the points that he makes is that when Moshe came to Egypt, there were people who doubted that he's really a messenger of God. And the great statement of the Kuzri is, Lo me sichutam, it was not because of their foolishness, Elo me chochmatam, from their wisdom. A person is going to come and say that God sent him? So what are we supposed to do? Prostrate ourselves and say, yeah? You have to make life miserable for him until he proves that it is so. I met somebody who tells me he has Ruach HaKodesh. I don't believe you. He was taken aback. I said, what are you talking about? I believe you have Ruach HaKodesh. Prove to me that you have Ruach HaKodesh. We have a responsibility to be doubters until it's proven to us beyond any shadow of a doubt. Jews are not a foolish people. You think Moshe Rabbeinu comes walking out of the desert and he says, the Lord God has sent me to take you out of Egypt. So they're all jumping already. Uh-huh. Mashiach is here, Mashiach, Mashiach, Mashiach. You have to prove it. That's your responsibility. You have to prove it to us. A Navi has to prove that he is a Navi. And we have the right, no, the responsibility to test him time and time again. Tell me what the weather is going to be tomorrow. And don't tell me the weather report in the Jerusalem Post, because that's not going to happen. Tell me the weather tomorrow. And he has to say it perfectly. We have a responsibility, because we're not fools, we have a responsibility to know and know the truth. It would stagger the imagination to say that millions of people believed that Moshe Rabbeinu was just this unusual individual, and it's all a hoax, it's all not true. Can't be. Of course, the Chofer over here also wants to let the Kuzari know no other religion has made claims of this sort. Nothing that comes to the VA Yisrael. There may be saints, or people who they say are saints because they claim that they saw some kind of a vision, but there's nobody that just went through fire, stayed 40 days and 40 nights. How many times does it say in Torah that I spent 40 days and 40 nights, I didn't eat, I didn't drink? We don't. We're talking about he's different in kind. Now watch. Here he's taking us, he's going to take us straight into the historical aspect. So number 43, these are some of the characteristics of the undoubted prophets to whom God made himself manifest and also made known that there is a God who guides them as he wishes according to their obedience and discipline. He revealed to those prophets that which was hidden and taught them how the world was created, how the generations prior to the flood followed each other, and how they reckoned their descent from Adam. He described the flood and the origins of the 70 nations from Shem, Ham, and Yefet, the sons of Noah. How the languages were split up and where men sought their habitations. How arts arose. In Torah we're told who was the first one that made metal implements, who was the first one that found, huh?
And flutes.
And flutes. Yuval and Tuval, Cain. How arts arose, how they built cities, and the chronology from Adam up to this day. He's going to keep going after Sefer Bereishis. Because you know what Sefer Bereishis is going to prove to me? I can say it in a sentence, in one sentence. The people, Jews in Egypt, were only a few hundred years away from the events that are described by Moshe Rabbeinu. He's going to say later on, what happens if I come to you today and I tell you 500 years ago, up to 500 years ago, everybody in the world spoke Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And one day they got up, and there were those who were speaking German and Hungarian and English. Would you believe me? Would you believe me? Of course you wouldn't believe me. Because we have books that are older than 500 years, and manuscripts 1,000 and 1,500 years old, and cuneiform and hieroglyphics and all the rest. There were all sorts of languages much earlier in history. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to these people who are not fools, they're intelligent people, and he tells them, you know, 500 years ago, everybody spoke Hebrew. And then one day, God confused their language. And you should know, these doubting Jews who questioned him time and time again didn't bat an eyelash. There wasn't a single Jew who said, "Oh, Moshe, you really expect us to believe that?" You know why they didn't question him? Reason number one, because they all knew it to be true. They all knew it to be true. He wasn't really telling them anything that was new to them. It was all part of the historic record. They knew it. Remember, Avram Avinu saw Noah. The flood. What Avram told Yitzchak when he was in pajamas before he went to sleep at night. But tell me again about the marble. Tell me what Noah told you about the marble. The point that he's going to be making is there's such a precise, we name names and we give dates. And the king is going to agree when you do something of this sort, when you're so specific, you can't get away with anything. A similar point is going to be made by the Chavir when he says, you know, the other religions promise all of the great Gan Eden after death. They don't promise you anything in this world. Torah is full of promises in this world. You know why? You promise something in the world to come, and absolutely nobody can question you on it. Nobody can question you on it. But this Shihab, after he blew himself up, came back and said, there weren't 70 virgins? Can't. You know, everything about Torah is such that can be put to the test. Historically can be put to the test. Everything about Christianity or about Islam can't put anything to the test. Yich veis what's going to happen to a Shia. The truth is, I don't know what's going to be in the Shia. He's going to burn in Gehenna forever and ever after. They keep stoking the coals every day. It's a self-cleaning oven down there. It says the details that Torah, and the truth is, when you know, we run through those parshas, we run through Bereshis and Noah, and then there are other parts of Torah where there seem to be psukim that are, you know, they're not of terrible interest to us. They list for us all the family of Esau, they list all the family of Yishmael. You should note that there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in every one of those psukim. And all you have to do is try and elicit all of the greatness of it. But on a general level, it's simple, because the more detail you say, the more you're telling us it's truth. There it is. There it is. Now, okay, number 44. It is strange that you should possess authentic chronology of the creation of the world. You know, that's pretty interesting. You go straight back in Torah to the creation of the world. So the rabbi says, surely we reckon according to it, and there's no difference between the Jews of Khazar and Ethiopia in this respect. You know what he's going to start pointing out now? That we have a precise number of years from creation. And wherever you can find a Jew dispersed any place on the face of the earth, it will be the same year. He's going to make another few fascinating points. Did you ever hear a week that wasn't made up of 7 days? Has any people on the face of this earth ever had a week that wasn't 7 days that ended with Shabbos?
No. Yes, there's
people. Yeah, all right, but... we're talking about, did anything of this sort ever take off? By the way, the Vatican wanted the UN. The UN was at one time in the 50s and 60s, they were thinking of changing the calendar. Changing the calendar, I think, to a 5-day week or a 6-day week. Of course, all Jewish organizations were up in arms about it. And the big question was, why would the Catholic Church be in favor of it? I mean, we knew that we would continue to keep a 7-day week. The Catholic Church was in favor of it only so that it would completely confuse and attempt to destroy the Jewish Shabbos. Unbelievable, so many commissions that were dealing with the changing of the calendar. In other words, to make a calendar that you print one calendar and it works forever. In other words, January 1st, every year is going to be on Sunday. And if you say January 1st to anybody in the world, any place, they know it's Sunday. It would call for all sorts of revamping of the, every few years or so, they have to make changes and adjustments in the calendar. It says, do you know of anybody that has a different system of counting than 1 to 10? The point that he wants to make is, everything had to start at one point in time with one person. That's the only it could have been. Any other way, you'd have two people, you understand? You'd have two different people. We wouldn't be counting from 1 to 10, Harayomase. I know what you're going to say. Of course, 10, the prime numbers have got 10 fingers. Right, what happens if you count your feet? So why isn't 20 the prime number? Now, there are certain things that can only be explained if we're talking about a world that came, was brought into being by a creator who created an intelligent being. It's the only way you can explain it. Any other explanation is going to fall short. Now he asked him, what date, 46, what date do you... Oh, we're going to finish right away. After number 47. What date do you consider it at present? So the rabbi said 4,900 years. The details, and that really comes out about the year 740 in the present Goyish County. Even though Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote it 400 years later. But he's describing in his mind an incident that had taken place 400 years earlier. And he says the details can be demonstrated from the lines of Adam, Shays, Enosh to Noah, then Shem and Eva to Abram, then Isaac and Jacob to Moses. We can go through Tanakh and make our way back precisely to 5,764. We can do it. We are capable of having a timeline going straight back, knowing everything that took place in every one of those years. All of them represented the essence and purity of God. Oh, here he's great. He's great in the respect that when he's giving the answer to one question, he's also dropping the kernel for the next idea. And he says, all of them represented the essence and purity of Adam. You see, he's coming to the idea, the gene, on account of their intimacy with God. Each of them had children, only to be compared to them outwardly, but not really like them. Then we say the children, some children were the peel, and others were the fruit, but not really like them, and therefore without direct union with the divine influence. The chronology was established through the medium of those sainted persons. How do we work our way back? Only through the people who had the genes of adoration, who were only single individuals and not a crowd, not a family, until Jacob had 12 tribes who were all under this divine influence. They all had the genes of Adam. Thus, the divine element reached a multitude of persons who carried the records further. The chronology of those who lived before these has been handed down to us by Moses. And from Moshe and further, we can figure it out. Jewish history has been around, and we know exactly what happened in Jewish history. We have no difficulty. We have no difficulty with that. Maybe one more paragraph, because that will really close this section. An argument of this kind removes any suspicion of untruth or common plot. The more details you have, the less it's possible that a cabal of people got together and said, let's make up a history. Not 10 people could discuss such a thing without disagreeing and disclosing their secret understanding. Nor could they refute anyone who tried to establish the truth of a matter like this. How is it possible where such a mass of people is concerned? What are you talking about? They're claiming that there were millions of people, these Jews finally. How is it possible where such a mass of people is concerned? Finally, the period involved is not large enough to admit untruth and fiction. What Moshe Rabbeinu is talking about is things that happened 400 or 500 years earlier. In other words, all of those seemingly unimportant details in Sefer Bereishis are all proof that Torah is absolutely true. You can't come and say such lies to intelligent people. Oh, really? Really? Everybody spoke Hebrew until one day everything said, what are you telling me, Mises? Bubamises. It's not Bubamises. It's Zedamises, because they heard it from their Zedas and everybody knew it to be true. What has to be understood in the background, of course, is that this kind of detail does not exist in Islam or in Christianity. It doesn't exist. About that whole period, they say, take a look at the Torah of Moshe. The Torah of Moshe will tell you the story of it.
to be continued. Should I give you homework?
Okay. I think you're getting into it. I think you're getting into it. I'm Shepard Nachman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, is there no books left? I have to sell them, and whatever's left over, I have to return. They're all gone? No. They're not all gone. Only one person bought a book for me today, and it was. Yes?
I pay you for the book, or at the desk?
Me. I'm the desk here.
You're the desk?
This.
You don't look like a desk.
I just came back from a lot.
I know. We missed you all this time.
Yeah. What can I tell you? Responsibilities in your life. Only the Jewish people in the world have prophets.
That's right.
And what did you say about Mashiach?
Whatever proof he had to give them, they had to show some.
I'm sure that I